For the week of May 30th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 56, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in the West End of London, where I'm looking forward to a jolly good podcast, I'm Michael Giltz.
Jolly good. Jolly good.
Yes, you're there seeing some theater, right?
That's right. Yeah, tonight I saw, winding down to the end of a West End show, a revival of Mrs. Warren's Profession by George Bernard Shaw, starring Felicity Kendall. Not very good.
Is George Bernard Shaw like an up-and-coming writer?
He's just a crazy kid with a dream.
Well, yeah, good. Okay. but you think he has some promise?
Absolutely. In fact, he's quoted on the marquee saying, "I decidedly believe this is my best play." It's like, well, thank you very much, Mr. Shaw. So he's promoting his own show.
Well, Michael, while you're still across the pond in London enjoying some theater, we're hopefully you got to watch a little bit of the Eurovision Song Contest over the weekend.
That's why I go to Europe, so I can watch the Eurovision Song Contest, which maybe a lot of people don't know. Sperling, why would I steal your thunder? For those who don't know, please tell them, Sperling.
Well, we're going to find out a little bit more about the Eurovision Song Contest later on. So it's a nice little tease. But first, we'll deliver, unfortunately, a couple of eulogies of prominent Hollywood celebrities who died in the past week. We'll update you on the plans to turn J.R.R. Tolkien's classic The Hobbit into a film. We'll try and unravel and understand the upcoming Karate Kid remake starring Jackie Chan. We have some news about...
Will Smith and Jada Smith are now, like, killing you right now.
Why? Oh, because I didn't mention their son is in it as well?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm sorry. Hip-hop star MIA has been making some waves lately after she was profiled in a New York Times Magazine story that she didn't much like. And our lightning round, Big Deal or Big Whoop, is just stuffed with so much entertainment news this week. I don't know how we're going to get through it all. And then finally, we'll end with a little inside baseball and talk about some of the changes going on over at The Hollywood Reporter. But as always, we first begin with Michael, who will fill us in on the box office returns for the Memorial Day holiday weekend. Or maybe it's more appropriate to say the lack of box office returns. Isn't that right, Michael?
Ouch. Yeah, you know, it's probably my fault for being in London, because normally I would go to whatever the number one movie of the weekend was. I would have seen Shrek Forever After. I would have seen Prince of Persia. I probably would have made myself see Sex and the City 2. And I would have seen Iron Man 2. I've seen none of these movies, but apparently a lot of other people aren't either. Now, don't worry, they're making money. I mean, Shrek Forever After has to be the only film in history to gross $70 million and be called a flop. But that's exactly, you know, what they're calling it. But it had a better second weekend. Shrek Forever After is number one for the week for the second week in a row. It grossed $55 million. It dropped about 21%, which blah, blah, blah is bad compared to previous holds in the second weekend, which is a Memorial Day weekend, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, it's grossed $145 million in the U.S. It's going to gross more overseas once, you know, soccer gets out of the way and they can start showing it in Europe. And that's where it's at right now. Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, however, opened poorly. I decided just to get the poster with Jake Gyllenhaal, but it opened to $37.8 million, and that's its total in the U.S. on a budget of $200 million. That looks very shaky.
It looked like a comedy, that movie.
Yeah. Sex and the City 2 grossed $37.1 million, $51 million total, lower than it did in the original, which is never a good sign for the second sequel. Iron Man 2 grossed $20 million. It's at $280 million in the U.S. It's holding pretty well. It's probably the only success story in the top five. And Robin Hood grossed $13.6 million for a total of $86 million total in the U.S. It's doing better overseas, but not earth-shakingly good. Overseas, it's grossed $154 million, I think. So it's not setting the house on fire. And then 6 through 10 are some holdovers, the best of which is Letters to Juliet, a little romantic drama, which is holding well. It grossed $7.2 million. It only dropped 19%. It's made $37 million total. It's a nice word-of-mouth modest hit. And the rest is Just Right, Queen Latifah's movie, which has made very little. Date Night, which is still chugging along, trying to get to $100 million. MacGruber, the god-awful spoof of MacGyver, which is about 20 years too late, which isn't even going to gross its $10 million budget, and How to Train Your Dragon, which is still bopping along. Did either of you go to the movies this weekend?
No, I was really busy. We should mention that it was a Memorial Day weekend here in North America, so a lot of people...
Good weather.
A lot of people were off on Monday, so it's a four-day weekend, and it was
a really big weekend for movies.
Yeah, it's like kind of the, at least in the U.S., the start of the holiday blockbuster season, although lately it's kind of moved to the beginning of May, and it was the lowest grossing Memorial Day weekend in 9 years, and the slowest in 15 years in terms of estimated attendance.
Which is great news.
Why is that great news?
Because almost all of these movies have been lambasted by critics, lambasted by people. They've gotten bad reviews. They should do poorly. And so often Hollywood can just pump a movie out and people will go anyway, like Transformers. And it doesn't seem to matter what happens. People go opening weekend, get suckered in. People have stayed away and they had good reason to. And every bit of word of mouth has been poor. So they should not open well. They should not make a lot of money. They shouldn't hold well. So it's good.
Well, Box Office Mojo agrees with you. They say the simple reason for these doldrums is the movies themselves. An indifference-inspiring brew of tepid holdovers and non-event new releases. And I have to say, Sex and the City 2, not really all that interested. Prince of Persia.
But you're not the audience either. I'm totally interested. I plan on seeing that movie.
Yes, that's right. 90% of those that attended that film were female, and I think it was 54% were under the age of 35.
And the 10% that were men were also the 10% of men that are gay.
Yeah, were dragged there by their wives.
No, they said, honey, that's your night out. You have fun. I'm going to go play poker. Yeah, but that movie got just ripped one by the critics. And the first one was bad. And this one was even worse. And
the first one was good.
Well, God bless you for thinking that. But this one got terrible, terrible reviews. The best reviews of the first one were like, well, it's okay. It did not get good reviews. Women might have gone to it and enjoyed it, but it didn't get good reviews. This one just got you know, skewered. So, and a lot of women are staying away. I mean, it grossed less opening weekend than the first one did, even if you include the Thursday totals.
I still plan on seeing it. But it might
so
be
it's a good sign. People shouldn't just flock to movies automatically every time. It's just, there's tons of ad publicity out there. So I think it's great. You know, a movie like How to Train Your Dragon gets good word of mouth. Great. Shrek Forever After, you know, if it's good, it will hold on. It doesn't matter where it opens. If people go to Prince of Persia and love it, it'll make its money back. But it won't if they don't like it.
Well, and there was a big deal made about the fact that, I guess, attendance is slipping. Attendance is flat. And
but next week we'll be talking about how attendance has gone up.
what's opening next weekend?
I think it was more kind of a
Killers, just in general. Which looks awful.
Yeah, attendance is slipping because they're bad movies.
Yeah, I mean they're not even screening that for critics, so
yeah,
because they're afraid that the critics are going to lambast them, which clearly
that's
seems
the word
to
of
be
the day.
Our word of the podcast.
Yes,
it's probably lambast, isn't it?
Maybe we should switch to shellac.
Shellac, we all know. Now, you wanted us to do some obits, but we're not going to actually deliver eulogies, are we?
No, we're not going to deliver eulogies, but we should mention, we kind of have to mention that Gary Coleman, the star of Different Strokes, which premiered in 1978, I believe, and was on until 1986, he died of a brain hemorrhage on Friday at the age of 42. His famous line was, "What you talking about?" I can't do
Willis.
It. Yeah,
Willis. Talk about Willis.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but he'd been plagued with illness his entire life, obviously. He was stunted growth because of kidney problems and health issues, and that's why he was so small, even though he was older than he seemed on TV.
Yes, in adulthood, he only reached 4'8", which is technically anything under 4'10", I believe, is considered dwarfism. And it was because at the age of 3, he was diagnosed with kidney failure, and the drugs they gave him to combat that stunted his growth. And he had his first transplant, I believe, at the age of 5. And he had another transplant within the past 10 years.
Well, if we want to be extra insensitive, let's talk about the fact that brain hemorrhages are clearly the thing to be having these days.
Yeah, really. Talk about it.
Yes. Well, you're referring to Bret Michaels, the lead singer of Poison, and now a reality TV star having a brain hemorrhage recently and being hospitalized for it. Now, of course, Gary Coleman, he had an accident at his house in Utah, 55 miles south of Salt Lake City, where apparently he fell on Wednesday and was in critical condition up until Thursday. And then on Friday, they just removed him from life support.
I love Bret Michaels, though. He's multiple health issues, but he made it to the finale of American Idol. That was awesome. And Gary Coleman, of course, I don't know if either of you have seen the Broadway musical Avenue Q.
Oh, yes, I have.
He's a featured character in the show. He's hi. Typically a female actress says, "Hi, I'm TV star Gary Coleman." And she has a big role on the show, actually. It's very funny. And they were actually asked, would they cut him from the show? And they're like, no, we wouldn't cut it. It's a tribute to the guy. It's in good nature, good humor. No reason to cut it. And, he's going to stay in the show as well. He should.
Well, Gary Coleman was also a candidate for governor of California back in 2003.
I totally forgot that until I read the show notes.
Yeah, he actually got over 12,000 votes. He came in just behind Larry Flint, the Hustler magazine publisher.
Huh.
And defender of the First Amendment.
Yes, well, as the movie The People versus Larry Flint will have you believe.
And of course, the other death last week was no surprise to anyone, Dennis Hopper, who died at 74.
Yes. I mean, he had been sick for some time. In March, when he appeared to for the unveiling of his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, he was incredibly frail and very thin, and he died of prostate cancer, which was revealed last October that he was ailing from that. And kind of sad because he has an art exhibit opening at the Los Angeles County Museum of Contemporary Art here in, obviously, Los Angeles. And it opens.
I don't think it's sad. I mean, it was sad how he had family and marital issues at the end and people sort of fighting over his estate as he became iller. But, you know.
Whatever happened with that? And is iller a word?
Iller is now a word. But, I mean, he was 74, and this is a guy who probably should have died at 30 with all the drugs he did. So, you know, he had a great second and third act in his life. So, you know, he had a good full life.
Yeah, I mean, he worked with James Dean, for Pete's sake, and John Wayne. He starred, his first film was Rebel Without a Cause. He starred in movies like Giant, Cool Hand Luke, Hang 'Em High, River's Edge, Rumblefish. Of course, he was in Speed and The American Friend and True Grit. He definitely had a full life. He was best known, of course, for Easy Rider.
Easy Rider.
Yeah, which won the Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah, not a film I would have liked if it did. I mean, I'm not a big fan of it, but it's certainly an iconic film, no question about that. And he directed it, of course, right? Didn't he? He directed it.
Yeah, oh yeah. And then he came.
Never directed anything else of note ever again, just a bunch of...
Isn't that interesting?
Well, because it wasn't really a good movie. It was sort of just captured the zeitgeist, you know? It was just a crazy, nutty film that somehow, with that music and that moment, would just struck a nerve. But to me, it's not a very good movie.
My sister went to high school with his daughter. Just a little bit of trivia for you.
Yeah, he was I mean, when I met him, he was always very cordial whenever I met him. And so I agree with you, Michael. His films that he directed were not that good. But
well,
there
were very few, but he was a terrific actor. I mean, yeah. He was great in Blue Velvet. That's what I mean. I can't even quote him on the podcast. You'd have to bleep it for hours. But, I mean, he's great in that movie. He's really sensitive and touching in Hoosiers. You know, he was a good actor.
Yeah, he was nominated for an Academy Award when he starred in Hoosiers alongside Gene Hackman. And, of course, that same year, he starred in Blue Velvet, which was, you know, David Lynch's big film. And he played the mystery, substance-inhaling, psychopathic killer, Frank Booth. He was kind of known for playing psychopathic weirdos.
Right, which is why Hoosiers was such a nice change of pace for him.
Right. Michael, you mentioned that his drug use, and in I think it was the Los Angeles Times, which had a very good obituary for him, he said that at one point in being interviewed by them throughout his career, that during the last 5 years of his abusing, he said, quote, "I was doing half a gallon of rum with a fifth of rum on the side, 28 beers and 3 grams of cocaine a day. And that wasn't getting high. That was just keeping me going, man."
Which is why 74 is not sad, but an accomplishment.
I had downloaded a clip to play for this little obituary.
I mean, what are they going to say, man, when he's gone, huh? Because he dies when it dies, man. When it dies, he dies. What are they going to say about him? What are they going to say? He was a kind man. He was a wise man. He had plans. He had wisdom. Bullshit, man. Am I going to be the one that's going to set them straight? Look at me wrong.
I thought that was fitting.
If people always die in threes, who's the third?
Well, Art Linkletter also passed away, and he was the host of...
Gary Coleman, Art Linkletter, and Dennis Hopper, yes.
Yeah, no, that's not quite it. That's not quite it. It's going to be some major...
Well, Art Linkletter was major, just not for this time.
Kids say the darndest things, especially what you talk about, Willis.
That's right. How very appropriate.
What was that a clip from? Was that Blue Velvet?
Ah, that was actually...
River's Edge?
No, that was Apocalypse Now, when he's talking...
Oh, right.
When he's talking to Martin Sheen, who's in the little cage there at the end of the film, and he's like all stoned, and he's got all of his cameras, and he's just like, who are they going to believe, man? Me? I don't think so. Look at me.
That's right. That's right.
Which is why it's very funny when he says, you know, and that wasn't getting high, man. That was just keeping me going.
I prefer the conversation. But anyway, great film.
Well, we should probably move on to The Hobbit, which Guillermo del Toro will not be moving on to. He's actually not going to direct The Hobbit because they can't set a start date for it.
This is like the biggest news. This was a bombshell to me. You know, I love The Lord of the Rings. I think it's one of the great accomplishments of the last decade, that trilogy. I love the books. I've read them many times. And, you know, I wanted Peter Jackson to make it. But when he said, you know, he'd done his thing and they chose Guillermo del Toro, he felt like the perfect choice. And everything he said has been so on target and so good and so right. And he moved his family to New Zealand. His kid, you know, I mean, he's been there for 2 years. He's so devoted to the project. He has such a deep connection to the books. He just seemed like the perfect choice for someone just like Jackson, who, I mean, I love Pan's Labyrinth, but he hasn't really quite broken through yet. But with this, it just seemed like the perfect guy at the perfect time to make these movies. And I was really gutted when I was like, oh my God, when I saw that news. I haven't been that shocked or surprised or something in a while.
Did he give a reason why?
Yeah, he did give a reason why. He said that that the uncertainty surrounding MGM caused the film to be delayed so many times that they couldn't even set a start date. And so he just was moving on. He had to, you know, he had foregone so many different projects to be on The Hobbit that he didn't want to continue.
Well, he'd committed to other movies. He has other movies lined up, which is funny because, again, he hasn't really broken through yet. He's never made a huge big hit film.
Well, but what about Hellboy?
What? Hellboy's not a big hit film. That's less than 100 million.
Okay. Well,
not big movies, but again, everybody knows he's a major talent. He's got a trilogy of books he's been writing. The first one came out was a bestseller called The Strain, I believe, that he's collaborating with someone on. He has two more of those coming out. Those will be turned into movies. He signed a 4-picture long-term deal with Universal. He's got 4 movies lined up, including Drood, which is a spin on a Dickensian novel by Dan Simmons, and a couple remakes in the works. And all of them were sort of stacked up, you know, over LAX waiting for The Hobbit. And so he had The Hobbit blocked out for 3 or 4 or 5 years of his life. And then those movies were going to come one after. You know, he's booked up for the next 10, 12, 15 years, literally, like an opera singer. And suddenly this movie's just not getting going.
Well, I mean, and that has everything to do with MGM, which is in some financial trouble and has been, as we've discussed on this show, for some time. Yeah, well, and now the hedge funds that gave it some money. Over, I think it's $3.7 billion MGM is in debt for. The hedge funds came in and said, you know what, we're taking over. So now the creditors have taken over MGM, and they are not accepting Warner Brothers' offer of $1.5 billion to buy the studio. This is the same reason that the producers of the James Bond franchise indefinitely postponed the 23rd installment of that a series, because they couldn't set a start date.
Wow.
Didn't Guillermo del Toro just drop out of something else not too long ago?
Maybe that was Benicio del Toro.
No, I don't think so. No, he's been locked up on this movie. He's been in New Zealand for 2 years. He's literally, his whole life has been devoted to this for the last 2 or 3 years. And he's still working on the screenplay, and it's all amicable on their end as far as him and the creatives. You know, he's still involved. They're still polishing the latest draft of the screenplay. And I don't even think it's good news in a way, because he didn't want to do it. But as Sperling linked to, Peter Jackson finally spoke to a New Zealand newspaper and said, yes, if he has to, not begrudgingly, but if that's the way to keep the investment safe and to make the movie happen in the time frame it needs to happen, he will consider directing it. But they are looking for another director now. But I think everybody feels like it's just a dreadful shame that Guillermo won't be the one.
And Karen, you'll be upset to know that the word 3D crossed Jackson's lips as he was talking about it.
Oh, God. Oh, no. I don't know. But a movie like that, I think it lends itself to 3D pretty well.
Yeah. Right, and it would be very subtle 3D. It wouldn't be like you're throwing a hobbit at the screen. You know, it would just be give it a modest sense of depth, I imagine. But, you know, I couldn't believe you said the budget was $150 million. That seems way low to make 2 feature films. I know even though they're shooting all at once, but given the money that Del Toro and Jackson and all those people, plus Ian McKellen and whoever else is signed, that just seemed a little cheap to me.
Well, you know what? If you have $150 million I could borrow, then I'll take you up on it.
But I am really – it's a movie I'm very – I mean, I would literally move to New Zealand to work on the Making of book. I would go get coffee on the set if I could. I literally tried to work on the Making of book for Lord of the Rings. I pitched myself. I sent letters. I should have just gone to New Zealand and shown up on the doorstep and said, what can I – I'll do anything.
Because that definitely would have worked.
When I saw a picture of Bilbo Baggins' door in the hill at Bag End – And they, you know, they laid the grass and they built the sets and they let it grow for like a year before they were going to start filming because they wanted it to look real. That's how much care they took. And when I saw a still that they released to the One Ring Net, and we should say that the news was broken on this Tolkien fantasy website, the One Ring Net, which shows the power of the web. That's where they decided to break the news. When I saw that image, I was like, oh my God, that looks absolutely real. I want to be there. That's well, how much of a geek I am.
Have you ever interviewed Guillermo del Toro?
Neither him nor Peter Jackson, but I will tell you, when they announced him and I thought it was such a good idea, I was literally like, I should buy some Spanish language tapes and learn Spanish so I can be on the set with him and converse more. If I got the job, I would literally learn Spanish so that I could talk to him better.
Well, he actually does speak fluent English, and
I'm sure, but he'd have Spanish crew or maybe whatever.
It's broken too, isn't it? I mean,
what's broken? His English?
His English is rather broken.
I don't know. When I've interviewed him, it's always been quite fluent. And he has this notebook that he draws in, this journal. And he draws all these elaborate and intimate pictures. And I saw the one for Pan's Labyrinth. And I was just amazed at how beautiful this book was. I told him, you should publish this book as written. In other words, you shouldn't type it out. It should just be photocopies, essentially, of each page. That's how beautiful this book looked.
Well, and I do think Pan's Labyrinth is a great film. It's one of my favorite of the decade. And so I do think he's a real talent, but I think he's just getting going. So it's a real shame he won't be on this.
Well, now, Michael, you highlighted a story about the Karate Kid remake, which is a story I never would have, really highlighted on Show the Sandbox. But
I was walking down the Croisette at Cannes, as one will, and there was a poster for the Karate Kid. And I commented at the time, I think I posted on Huffington Post, I said, why? I looked it up, and the Jackie Chan character was not Mr. Miyagi. It was called Mr. Han. And I was like, why is he not called Mr. Miyagi? Why would you change that name? That makes no sense to me at all. That's ridiculous. Well, now I have the answer, which is that this new Karate Kid remake is set in China. Instead of a kid from Jersey moving to Los Angeles, which was the Ralph Macchio version, this is a kid from Detroit, Jaden Smith, obviously, moving to China. His mom gets a job in China. And so he's literally in China. He's bullied by some Chinese kids. And then he meets a Chinese man, Jackie Chan, who plays Mr. Han. And Mr. Han teaches him how to defend himself. And in fact, of course, there is no karate in The Karate Kid because it's China. Karate is a Japanese martial arts, and he learns kung fu. So that explained everything to me. And they shoot on like the Great Wall and in the Forbidden City. They shot all over China and got all the permission they need. And the Chinese government, of course, was, you know, happy to work with them, but was very nervous too. They're like, do they have to bully him? And they're like, yes, no, you need to have bullies or there can't be any fight and then he can't triumph. But so that's why Jackie Chan's character is called Mr. Han and all that sort of stuff.
So shouldn't this be called the Kung Fu Kid?
Well, exactly.
Funny you should mention that.
The studio actually considered that, and the original producer of the movie, Jerry Weintraub, who's involved in some way, was like, are you an idiot? Like, of course it should not be called the Kung Fu Kid. It's the Karate Kid. That's worth millions. You don't change the name.
Yeah, but if he's not doing karate, if he's doing kung fu, that's...
The Kung Fu Kid just doesn't work. You got that brand, baby.
Kung Fu Panda, Kung Fu Kid.
You know, they actually screened this film at Show West back in March for theater owners in Las Vegas, and I didn't get a chance to see it. I was in meetings, but the people that did see it, they said, well, it's not bad, but it's not overly good either, and it was way too long. Everybody agreed, whether they liked it or hated it, they thought it was too long.
Well, I'm sure it's a rough cut, right?
I'm pretty sure that it wasn't complete.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very commercial idea, and I thought Jaden was really good in The Pursuit of Happiness with his dad, so I'll be interested to see it.
I don't know. He sort of bugs me.
Well, before we move on, we should take a little break here. Pause for a little break. And when we come back, we will be covering music. And that includes that Eurovision Song Contest. So a little teaser there for you. But, we thought it would be a good idea to get in the habit of breaking for a message for our sponsors. Not that we have any sponsors, but, you know, we want to be prepared and we're trying to think positively. But whenever a show or program doesn't have a sponsor, they play a house spot, plugging another show on the same network or an upcoming episode, which is exactly what you're listening to right now, a house spot highlighting something that for the first year of our show, we didn't do much with, but recently we started paying attention to it and updating it regularly. Of course, that is our YouTube channel. And you can visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/showbizsandbox, and we encourage you to stop by and subscribe. Presently, we have a little video posted from the Coachella Music Festival, and this week I plan on uploading a couple of video reports I filed for The Hollywood Reporter while in Cannes, which Michael and Stephen Garrett helped out with. But what you'll really want to bookmark and subscribe to our YouTube channel for is our selection of favorites, because we're highlighting all the cool and relevant YouTube videos we come across so that you'll know what the latest viral videos are, sometimes even before they go viral.
Really? We are?
Well, yeah. And an interesting one I found this week is a take on the Apple commercials. It's titled, "Hi, I'm a Marvel, and I'm a DC," and uses comic book characters. And let's see if I can pull it up here. And
so obviously the Marvel is the Apple, and then DC is Microsoft.
Yeah, who knows? I was going to actually mention the Les Grossman promos for the MTV Movie Awards, except they are just profanity-filled. I started watching one and was like, well, okay, we can't do that. But Tom Cruise reprises...
Is that the Tom Cruise joke thing? Yeah.
Yeah, and he's yelling at Robert Pattinson in one of them. He's, you know, I think he starts off by saying, "Bobby, MTV's got mad wood over you appearing on the MTV Movie Awards."
They've got mad wood?
Well, he's grabbing his crotch while he's doing it.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah, okay.
I tried to look at it, but you can't access it in Europe.
Ah, okay. Well, it's very funny. And if MTV takes it down off of YouTube, that would be a mistake. But here's a little clip from Hi, I'm a Marvel.
Hi, I'm Iron Man.
I'm Batman.
I'm a Marvel. He's Batman. Gotta love it. So, looks like it's my turn to have a number one sequel at the box office, but not without our fair share of criticism. Some say the movie suffers from having too many new characters and plot threads, but what are you gonna do?
That was surprisingly humble of you to say, Tony. I guess I expected a lot more showboating from you.
I'll tell you what you do. Set him straight. Hit it. Sure, I could kick Kick-Ass's ass. The losers would be lost. And no one knows if Jonah Hex can make back what he cost. But we at Marvel have a plan. Quite simply, it's divine. A plan you spell C-O-N-T-I-N-U-I-T-Y. In my new film, Black Widow and Nick Fury got to shine.
Okay, so you kind of get the idea. That it's kind of a little musical with all the little action figures playing the roles. So if you visit our YouTube channel, youtube.com/showbizsandbox, and subscribe today, you will stay on top of all of our updates, whether they're ours or our favorites. We now return to our regularly scheduled program, already in progress. I was going to thank our sponsor for their support, but we don't, you know, we'd be thanking ourselves. Okay, Michael, you watched the Eurovision Song Contest, yes?
I did.
And does it compare to American Idol?
No, not at all.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about the Eurovision Contest. It's something that's gone on for decades. And
yeah, it started in the 50s, I think, or the 40s.
I believe
so.
Yes.
And it's just a nutty, campy night. Nobody will care about it the day after it's over, but for the night you care. It's launched careers. Basically, every country in Europe gets to submit a song each year. So every country does it their own way. This year, the UK had a reality show to find the guy who would sing the song. You know, everybody has a different approach. But they come up with a song, and they submit it, and then a certain number get to the finals, and then they get to perform on one night. Everybody performs a song, and everybody from every country in Europe votes on it. You can't vote for your own country, so you vote for your favorite in another country. And over the years, it's launched groups like ABBA. Katrina and the Waves had their final big number one hit on Eurovision. Celine Dion performed on Eurovision, even though she's from Canada. I think she did it for Switzerland. But, you know, it launched careers, and it was campy and silly and whatever. It's in the last 5 years, it's been overtaken by block voting and, like, you know, Bulgaria will vote for Hungary and Hungary will vote for Bulgaria. And it's all this sort of, I don't know how it works, but somehow the countries all work in concert. So a little of the fun's gone out of it, but it's always a campy, silly night. And nobody cares about it the day after it's over, but it's fun. And this year there was a lot of excitement. Germany won for the second time in the entire Eurovision history. It was a song called Satellite. A guy ran on stage during Spain's performance, really early in the show. So Spain got to perform their song twice. And there were a couple good songs, actually. The guy from Belgium was really cute. And the guy from Cyprus was good, too. He did a good job. So there was actually some quality songs. Usually they're big, crazy, nutty ballads. And these people who don't speak English, it's their second language, are trying to sing phonetically English. And so they have very strange dialogue and very strange. And the campiest moment of the night this year was definitely Belarus, which had this song, Butterflies. And they had three female backup singers. And the song was like, we are butterflies flying into the sun. We are butterflies. And at the big dramatic finale, the three women pulled on some strings or something, and these chintzy little butterfly wings jumped out from behind their beautiful gowns, and suddenly they had beautiful butterfly wings. And if you saw
it,
it was hilarious. If you just, you know, YouTube Eurovision and butterflies, you'll see it. It's very, very funny.
Well, you know, one of the things that the Eurovision winner will get to host the event next year. So last year, Norway won, so the event was held this year in Oslo, Norway. And next year, I guess it will be held in Germany. And we do have a little clip from this year's event of the winner, which is highlighted on our YouTube channel. So let's see if I can get that to play. Okay, here we go. I'll tell you, she's really cute.
Well, she's like 19 years old, and it came out of nowhere. Okay.
It's a pretty decent song, even
well,
though
it's already, catchy, been, a, it's like already it. Been a number one. It was already a number one hit in Germany. It's been a hit all over Europe. It's kind of made it less fun too. It's like, you know, it's sort of a night where you're supposed to discover a new song. It's already been a big hit. It sort of doesn't feel fair.
And her name is Lena Meyer Landrut, and I can tell you she's got a lot of appeal. I mean, the song's really good, and she's kind of sexy.
She's 19.
So she can still be sexy at 19, no?
At least she's not, you know, 16.
14, yeah.
Yeah, well,
but
that's true.
More than we should talk about Eurovision. You know.
It's, okay.
It's just a campy night of fun. That's it.
Okay, well, we could talk about Brazil, but we should probably skip over the fact that in Brazil, it's not Lena Meyer Landrut and cute girls making hits. It's actually priests, but we're kind of pressed for time. Bottom line on that story is the top selling records in Brazil for 2009 were all by Catholic priests. Don't ask me why. Instead, we should go on to MIA. We kind of teased this at the beginning of the episode, but the New York Times Magazine published an article written by Lynn Hirschberg, who in 1992 wrote a scathing Vanity Fair profile of Courtney Love. And she did it on MIA, the hip-hop rapper. I don't know what you'd really define her as. She's kind of a pop star. She's about to release her third album, and it focuses a lot on her sense of fashion, but also a lot on her political beliefs and support of Sri Lanka's Tamil Tigers, which is a separatist group that has resorted to terrorist tactics in the past. And in January 2009, while the civil war in Sri Lanka was raging, Maya, as she is referred to, or as people call her, she referred to the situation as genocide, and she said, "I wasn't trying to be like Bono. He's not from Africa. I'm from there. I'm tired of pop stars who say, give peace a chance. I'd rather say, give war a chance. The whole point of going to the Grammys was to say, hey, 50,000 people are going to die next month, and here's your opportunity to help out. And no one did." Well, needless to say, that was just one of many quotes in this long piece. I mean, this piece makes, I don't know, you know, For Whom the Bell Tolls look like a pamphlet. It's got to be like 20,000-30,000 words. It's so long. But
well, she is one of the more acclaimed. I'm not a big fan of hers, but she is one of the more acclaimed artists of the last 5-10 years. Both of her albums were high on critics' polls the years they came out. She's definitely somebody that critics all over the world have touted as a serious cutting edge artist. I've never really been a fan, but people do like her. And that song "Paper Planes" was great.
Well, it's funny that you say that she's a cutting edge artist and that people are, you know, touting her as this big musical act, because in reality, as this article points out, she has no musical talent. She just kind of was hanging out with some guy in St. Vincent one day, and he was missing or he was kind of out and about, and she started playing around with his drum machine and created a song. And that's effectively how she works today. She doesn't really know music. She's not a musician. And I always...
Well, there's plenty of artists
but
who can't
read
music.
A lot of people are not musicians. Yeah. I mean, Beyoncé is not a musician.
That doesn't mean they don't count. She does have songwriting credits on her album. So she's not a you know...
Milli Vanilli or something.
Yeah.
Yes. However, she is more known for her beats, more so than her lyrics. And she writes all the lyrics, and all these producers like Diplo and, well, there's just a whole bunch of producers that she works with. They are all kind of the power behind her because they're the ones coming up with the music.
She's a college master. She's graduated in London with a degree in fine art, film, and video. She's not some, you know, ditzy little thing.
Yeah, when she's...
She's had exhibitions of her paintings in 2001. She's, you know, she's...
She's got a lot of talents.
Yeah. Well, I don't like her, but, you know, I don't think she's just a cardboard cutout.
Yeah, she's not a non-talent.
Diplo, the DJ that produced Paper Planes and some of her other work and also, I guess, produces some of the songs on her upcoming album, said of her, "In the end, Maya is postmodern. She can't really make music or art that well, but she's better than anyone at putting crazy ideas into motion. She knows how to manipulate, how to withhold, how to get what she wants." And, you know, I think the same could be said, by the way, of Madonna.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think a lot of guys would probably say the same about a lot of women, period.
Yeah, Madonna gets co-writing credits on most of her hits or solo credits. She picks obscure people or cutting edge young producers. Works with new talent all the time. She's a terrific artist. We only care about it because she writes great singles, and she's involved in writing most of her songs.
I love this little passage from the article. It says, "Unity holds no allure for Maya. She thrives on conflict, real or imagined. I kind of want to be an outsider," she said, eating a truffle-flavored French fry. I don't want to make this.
What is that about?
Well, that's just Hirschberg taking advantage of the fact of where they were doing the interview.
Right.
It's a cheap blow in my mind.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't find her an interesting or deep thinker, but most rock stars aren't. Her last album was named the best album of the year by Rolling Stone and Blender. And, you know.
Well, and she kind of rose to fame by saying, "Oh, my father was this rebel, and he was a peace fighter."
No, she rose to fame by recording music that got played all over the world.
Right, but part of her biography, and this is how I came across her, was that her father, Arular, which is the name of her first album, was this peace fighter in Sri Lanka. And it turns out that Lynn Hirschberg discovers he's actually a teacher in London. So that whole story was kind of fabricated.
Yeah, so she lied about her past.
Yeah, which I'm sure many artists
did. So what?
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, no, I don't find her very interesting, but...
I think you should read the piece, though. It's very, very interesting. It's a worthy read.
I don't like her enough to read it. Why would I?
Because it's just an interesting journalism.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the obnoxious thing that she did was...
Well, she, you should say...
But she, meaning MIA, posted the author Lynn Hirschberg's phone number online, pretending it was her own, and said, "Hey, give me a call, contact me," just to have people harass Lynn Hirschberg. At least she didn't say it was Lynn's. But
that's terrible. That's really disgusting.
Yeah, she sent it out over Twitter, and Hirschberg said, "It's a fairly unethical thing to do, but I don't think it's surprising. She's a provocateur, and provocateurs want to be provocative." And then she said, "The messages have mostly been from people trying to hook up with MIA. If she wants to get together with John at Bard next week, I have his number."
Which is the only way you can respond to such a stunt.
Yes. I suppose we should maybe move on to television?
Yeah.
I always like to move on to television.
Well, this week, Karen, if you're a big fan of soap operas...
Oh, yeah.
Disney has decided to dump SoapNet in lieu of a kids' network. And SoapNet, which was... I guess, launched in 2000. It mostly showed reruns of soap operas and different ABC family shows. So
it was a pre-DVR idea that if you missed General Hospital during the day, you could watch it at night in prime time.
Right, exactly.
And then have soap-related shows about the soaps and interviews with the stars of soaps. Everything soap.
Right, so Disney decided, you know what? The DVRs here, they don't really need this network anymore. We're in 75 million homes. So we may as well expand Playhouse Disney into its own network and launch it in 2012 in place of SoapNet.
Yeah, this is really a sign of the times. This is just the death of the soap. I think in 5 years, obviously, maybe one network will still be showing daytime soaps, if that.
Well, yeah.
You know, this daytime soap is just dead.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, soaps are dying and kids' TV is booming. And so this makes perfect business sense. And
I mean, it's almost not even a news story. Does anybody really watch SoapNet?
Not anymore, no.
So then maybe.
Well, they had reruns like One Tree Hill and Gilmore Girls, and they had one or two shows that they tried to latch on about. If it had launched in the 80s, it probably would have worked well. But
exactly what you said. In the era of DVRs, it doesn't work at all. I remember before DVRs were huge, I used to watch SoapNet. I would watch like Dynasty.
Yes,
but
exactly.
The bad thing about that, though, is that it's so dated, you almost can't watch it anymore. So that was probably another reason why it failed.
Does anything date faster or worse than a primetime soap like Dynasty or Dallas or probably even One Tree Hill? I mean, did those shows, Melrose Place, you know, those things date so quickly.
You know, but I don't know if you can say that about the ones in the 80s, because if they were really done well, and, you know, some people would argue that Dallas and Dynasty were done really well. I just think they just happened to have worked at the time. But good writing should not date itself.
Yeah, but primetime soaps don't flourish on good writing. They flourish on
that's
broad,
exactly, yeah. Which is why it didn't work.
But overall, you're saying that SoapNet going away is not a big deal.
No. Oh, that's a transition.
Yes, that was a segue into our lightning round, our popular segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they were a big deal or if anyone should care about them. I think we have like 12 stories here, so we're going to have to fly through some of these. Lee DeWise beat out Crystal Bowersox to win American Idol as the show finale hit its lowest ratings since the season one summer finale. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, unfortunately, it is a big whoop because nobody watched it. And that's the only big deal here, really. That and the fact that the girl who should have won didn't.
Michael?
Yeah, I think it's a big deal. This is the second year in a row where the frontrunner got shafted in the finale. Last year, I was rooting for the runner-up, Chris Allen. This year, I was rooting for the frontrunner. So it's not sour grapes on my part. I feel like the show jumped the shark in a way. Simon's gone. The people you expect to win aren't winning. And it didn't matter. You didn't always have to win to break out. But when it comes down to the final two, really the best one should kind of win usually sometimes. And
but, you know,
2 years
really
in a row is kind of bad.
Yeah, it's interesting that it says so much about America that they, you know, the little teeny bopper girls voted for the good-looking guy and the girl who's got the dreadlocks was shafted.
Yeah.
Moving on to our next story, James McAvoy is the first big name to sign on to the X-Men prequel, X-Men First Class. Good God, why are they doing this?
Hey, my friend Zoe's in London cast in the film.
Oh, sorry. Well, McAvoy will be playing the Patrick Stewart role as a young man. If it works, he could grow from the next Hugh Grant to a genuine British action star, not in a Bond film. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal because I love James McAvoy. I think he's great. And for them to sign him as the first one to the movie is really a coming of age for him. So I'm very excited.
Karen?
Big deal for the exact same reason.
Ellen DeGeneres is playing a new role, record company mogul. She's launched a record label and announced her first signing, a 12-year-old YouTube sensation called Grayson Chance. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
We'll see.
Michael?
It's a big whoop. You know, a record label? That's like opening a smithy.
What you're saying is she opened up a buggy whip story.
Right, exactly. Though it's funny that she should do this just as she becomes, you know, on Idol. I did think she got better on Idol.
That's no coincidence.
No coincidence at all.
Nightline created controversy when it veered into Barbara Walters territory, as we mentioned last week, by snagging an interview with adulterer Jesse James. I like the fact that he's known as adulterer, not like a mechanic or, you know, reality TV star. That's a far cry from Ted Koppel grilling top government officials and politicians. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. Well, I know, you know, it's a big whoop. It's like, well, why would I be surprised that Nightline would do that when they're one of their big hosts is a guy who snagged the interview with Michael Jackson? So, you know, big deal, big whoop.
Karen?
Yeah, I agree. It's a big whoop. And just the fact that I think it's a big whoop, it's actually sort of sad.
Well, 7 million people watched the show. So that's actually kind of a
but
big
what is
deal.
That to me the
that
The big news here is like, oh God, what have we become as people? That we all tune in and watch that.
People would watch that, and Nightline did it. It's just on every level, it's sad.
Yes. I totally watched it though.
How was he? Was he sympathetic at all?
He was actually. And it was funny because I was also watching Entertainment Tonight earlier that had a body language expert on it, and you know, looking at the interview and commenting on it. And according to the body language expert, he was being truthful. You know,
That's why I tell my male clients, wear a girdle when you go on these shows so that you will have good posture and they'll never be able to spot you.
But it's not about posture. It's about how he holds his hands and how, you know, when you're really trying to hold yourself back emotionally, you look down and to the left, you know.
I just want Jesse James to be in a girdle. But, and of course, I bet Nightline asked him all the tough questions. Did they say, now, are you a Nazi? And he said, no, I am not.
More or less, yeah. You know, he actually did talk. You know, it wasn't just yes or no. It was things like him saying that if that picture had come out at any other time, it wouldn't have been that big deal. But because it came out when it did, it was just kind of all a part of the bigger story.
Yeah.
Well, we've already spent way too much time on this story, so we'll move on. The Gorillaz will replace U2 at the Glastonbury Festival as its headliner. U2 had to back out because of back surgery for Bono. The Gorillaz said, hey, wait a second. We're animated. We never need back surgery. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
How about big silly? Odd. It's odd.
Michael?
It's a big whoop, but I do like their quote. Read that quote from them.
Murdoch from Gorilla said, we're like some great big horrible warship pulling into the Bay of Glastonbury to save the day. It was us or the Beatles, and they split up years ago.
It's funny.
Hey, I saw them play Coachella, and they were fantastic. So
yeah, they're a really good band.
Glastonbury has a treat in store for them. Moving on to model Rosie Huntington-Whiteley. Megan Fox was dumped from Transformers 3 for dissing producer Michael Bay. Her replacement, Victoria's Secret model Rosie Huntington-Whiteley. Clearly, they haven't rethought the role to involve actual acting. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, except for her family.
Whose family? Karen?
Oh, I agree. Same reason.
I did like Shia LaBeouf's quote, though. He said, yes.
Well, you know, he starts...
Are you being serious? Really?
No, I'm joking.
Oh, God.
Well, you know, he starts shooting this film, I think, in 2 weeks. So she better figure out how to act fast.
She doesn't have to. You said it yourself.
Never stop Megan Fox. Can't act.
Well, Michael Bay continued to make news last week with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. In fact, you can't keep good mutant turtles down. The heroes on a half shell, named after Renaissance artists and trained by a talking rat, were a worldwide phenomenon in the 80s, and they're coming back. A live-action feature film and a TV series on Nickelodeon are in the works for 2012 via Michael Bay. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Ugh, the only big deal is that people are going to continue doing this. Please, people. I want to have an original movie and an original thought.
Michael?
I'll say it's a big deal because it may be the first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles product I will actually watch. I've never seen any of them. I have not watched a second of the TV show or any of the movies, the comic books, nothing. I missed it all.
Well, you know.
You will love them.
Really?
Yeah, you will. I mean, for like 15 minutes, you know, maybe seven minutes. But after that, yeah.
Well, what I think is interesting is that they are calling it a reboot, but I always thought that the 2007 Warner Brothers CGI version was supposed to be the reboot for this franchise. So
they call everything reboots. They don't call them.
But that was a cartoon, right? And that was such a ridiculously bad idea. The whole camp appeal of them was seeing the guys, right? I mean, in the live action film, that it just didn't seem to make sense as a cartoon for a feature film.
I think that's spoiled.
Just the ads made me think that was stupid.
Well, maybe this next story will make sense then. Luc Besson, the French Michael Bay, behind such films as The Fifth Element, La Femme Nikita, and District 13, has a novel approach to combating piracy. Let the public take part in making the movie. Online fans can help choose the script, vote on casting, and even invest into a new project he's developing. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop as far as fighting privacy, but it's a lot of fun.
Karen?
Well, this has been done before, despite not by somebody of Luc Besson's caliber. It's it's another one. We'll see.
Let's not say caliber. Let's say his profile.
Star power?
Yeah, exactly. Because, boy, I hate his stuff, except for District 13, which was pretty fun. Oh, I hate all his work. Everything he's done, I can't stand.
Finally this week, The Ghost Whisperer fades to black. The long-running Jennifer Love Hewitt vehicle on CBS was being considered for pickup by ABC, but they've decided against it, and the show is gone for good. So now Jennifer Love Hewitt can communicate with her own deceased TV show. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I'd rather see Jennifer Love Hewitt communicating with her own deceased TV show. It's a big whoop. It was time.
Michael?
You're absolutely right. Big whoop.
Okay, well, that wraps up our lightning round of Big Deal or Big Whoop. And I'd like to say record time. We covered 9 items. We should probably move on to Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss only the news stories that Hollywood might care about. And we have like a ton of news stories here, too. This was a busy week.
I think we should just cover Hollywood Reporter.
Okay, so what we're going to skip over, just so you know, is a Disney executive assistant being arrested for insider trading. Whoever this was, Bonnie Hoxie, I think her name is, what an idiot, thinking that she could sell inside information to hedge funds and that the hedge funds wouldn't turn around and report her to the FBI. Very dumb.
Frankly, I'm surprised that kind of thing hasn't happened before.
Well, they just haven't gotten caught.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we're also going to skip over this story about Kenneth Starr, who at first I thought was the prosecutor.
Ken Starr.
Yeah, Ken Starr.
Different guy.
Yeah, it's a different guy, not the Bill Clinton era Ken Starr, completely different guy. This Ken Starr is, I guess, an accountant and investment advisor, and he was arrested for a Ponzi scheme bilking some of his clients, who just happen to be Uma Thurman, Goldie Hawn, Candace Bergen, Martin Scorsese, Ron Howard, former William Morris chairman, Jim Wyatt, Anna Leibovitz, and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. So probably not good clients to be bilking out of money. In any case, Michael, you wanted to talk about the dramatic makeover of The Hollywood Reporter.
Tell us about it.
The 80-year-old trade publication is planning to go a little bit more mainstream and, quote, tap into the country's fascination with show business, end quote. And that came from the LA Times. It's a surprise move by the new owners of the scrappy trade publication, Janice Min, who edited celebrity magazine Us Weekly from 2003 until 2009, was named the editorial director of The Reporter. She is expected to radically transform The Reporter from a weekday trade paper into a slick weekly magazine aimed at high-end readers. And Min says, in an interview she did with the LA Times, she doesn't want to turn The Reporter into Us Weekly and, quote, "The Hollywood Reporter is never going to tell you about Paris Hilton making a left turn on La Cienega Boulevard."
I love that.
It will cater to, yeah, that was very funny. It will cater to the influencers of Los Angeles and the small consumer group that has a fascination with how the sausage is made in Hollywood. The opportunity is to put all of that in a larger context and elevate the discussion of the entertainment industry. I thought that was a really good quote, actually.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Michael?
Well, her first hire is certainly a, you know, they're obviously pumping money to it because she's hired Kim Masters, who's a terrific reporter. I don't think I ever actually worked with her. Maybe I did work with her at Primer Magazine, but I certainly have known her for many years. I know Nancy Griffin that she worked with. But, you know, she's worked for Vanity Fair and Tina Brown's website, The Daily Beast. And so that's a serious hire, and that's serious money because she's a talented reporter. It just, to me, you know, anybody wants to launch a magazine in this day and age, Godspeed, more power to you. A Vanity Fair for covering Hollywood, I guess, is that the idea? I'm not sure what it is, but why anyone would want to launch a print magazine in this day and age, I don't know. I mean, I thought if any play was there for Hollywood Reporter, it was going strictly online, but, you know, I don't get it.
Well, we should say, you know, just to kind of highlight the person you were talking about, this journalist, Kim Masters, wrote for Vanity Fair and The Daily Beast, The New York Times, Washington Post, Time Magazine, LA Times. She's got a show on KCRW called The Business, which covers show business. So that's not Janice Min. Janice Min hired her. That was her first hire. And I'd agree with you. That's a phenomenal hire. Kim Masters is a really good writer.
Well, there's plenty of people available for hire. That's not my point. You could hire, obviously, if you've got freaking who's working at at IndieWire? Who was the
Thompson?
People? Yeah, loaning their name to that magazine. You know, I mean, you can get anybody if you're willing to spend money. I'm just saying that's a sign of willing to spend money, which they have to do. But who wants to launch a magazine in this environment?
But The Hollywood Reporter didn't really have a choice because they're free online, and
well,
that's
I
how they
bought it. They're not. I wouldn't have bought it.
Well, no, I don't disagree, but that's how they trump Variety online, because Variety online, it's got a paywall. So right. Everybody I know reads a Hollywood Reporter online. So how are they going to make money? They have to have. I mean, well, one way to do that is by having the hard copy.
Except,
but Janice Mann is not an idiot. I mean, she turned Us Weekly around when it was just Us Magazine. She turned that around and really made it successful. And if you've ever seen her interviewed, she's very articulate. She's smart.
Well, but she can't ignore the environment we're in, though. You know, the name of the Hollywood Reporter has no currency for the wider public. Not only people would ever say, I want to read the Hollywood Reporter. So you're kind of launching it anew with a name that doesn't really resonate with people that you're trying to reach outside the tiny little Hollywood sliver.
But it's got Hollywood in it. I mean, you've got that one thing. You've got that one word in it. And if anybody can do it, I'll bet it's her.
And yeah, to your point, Karen and Michael, when Janice Mann was in charge of Us Weekly, circulation skyrocketed to 1.9 million readers, which is – that's quite a readership. E5 Global Media purchased The Hollywood Reporter in December, so this is one of their first major, major hires. Ben Fritz and Rachel Abramowitz of the Los Angeles Times agree with you, Michael, that launching – and this is a quote – launching what would essentially be a new magazine with an old name in a very challenging economic environment for media companies is a big risk, though it seemed clear that as the second-place publication in a shrinking space, the Reporter needed to make a bold move, end quote. And that shrinking space, they actually had 5 rounds of layoffs at The Hollywood Reporter in the last 5 years, losing more than 60% of their staff as readership and ad sales dropped 45%. The readership dropped to 18,582 from 2006 to September 2008.
Their paid subscriptions were 18,000?
Yes.
Holy moly, why would you even buy that? Wow.
Because people already were. I mean, that's...
Wow.
And they will continue to break news online. So they will continue to do kind of breaking news online and then do
I think they're going to be like Entertainment Weekly.
I think that there is room for analysis.
I think they're trying to go more upscale than that.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at The Economist, it's the only magazine that's really making a go of it, and it's because they're taking the week's news and providing some really interesting editorial around it, some analysis, some good commentary on what's going on in politics and the – well, I'm sorry, what?
Maybe they could use a savvy podcast.
Very interesting. Well, I actually did ask Janice Mann to join us here on today's show to talk about this and all of her upcoming plans and really entertainment journalism in general, the state of it today. And I friended her on Facebook, which is how I found her, and sent her an email through Facebook. And this is why I think The Hollywood Reporter under Janice Mann will succeed. I think it will succeed because she totally gets it. Within 24 hours, she had not only accepted my friend request, this is not why I'm saying that, but more importantly, she actually responded saying, I'm going to pass on any more media until I'm there for a while. I'm not even starting until mid-June. But thanks so much for thinking of me and for the congratulations. And I thought to myself as I was reading this, within 24 hours, she responded. She totally gets it. She gets it.
Well, first of all, probably wasn't her, but just the fact that she hired somebody to respond for her.
No, it most definitely was her. If you look at her Facebook page, it's definitely her.
No, but I mean, somebody could have managing it. Her intern is doing it, or.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, it's not necessarily her typing at it.
But still, she at least has the foresight to hire somebody to.
That's what I'm saying. That's my point. Yeah.
Well, good luck to anyone who wants to launch a new magazine.
Well, and I look forward to seeing the changes that she's going to make at The Hollywood Reporter. I mean, I think Patrick Goldstein of the LA Times is right that you can go nowhere but up from here.
Well, and there's no reason why magazines should disappear forever because, you know, a well-done one should work. I buy The Atlantic every month and love it, and there are others I buy and will always buy. So, you know.
And something else that comes out once a week is our podcast, which you can find on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or on our website. ShowbizSandbox.com is our website, and that is also where you will find links to all of the stories we talked about, including these last two stories about The Hollywood Reporter. You can look up these links in the show notes for episode 56. Our website is also where you will find links to all of our social networking accounts, including YouTube and Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn. So stop on by. You can also find ways to contact us. Send us an email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. It's toll-free, 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is not by
M.I.A.
Is not by M.I.A. That is correct. It is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group, who will not sing kids at any of their upcoming concerts. So don't expect them to sing their big hit song. However, you can go and hear it on their website, whoismgmt.com. You can look up Michael's writing on his website, michaelgiltz.com, or you can follow him on Twitter. @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. You can follow Karen on Twitter. Her username is quite complicated. It's @Karen_Woodward online. No, wait, what is it? @Karen_Woodward. That's the username, right?
Yep.
And your website is KarenWoodwardOnline.com.
Right.
I've got to write this down. It's so complicated.
No, it's easy.
You can find some of my writing on CelluloidJunkie.com, or you can follow me on Twitter. @Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.